Chapter 15. Malakhurst. Light and dark, dark and light, sliced by the passing seconds. Light, dark, light,
Mal?
He must have fallen unconscious on the tunnel floor. He remembered blood, a lot of blood.
This is a death wound,
he said, raising a red hand in front of his eyes. The shadows of the tunnel shifted and swam before him. The hair of his topknot hung lank down the back of his neck, matted and sticky. Where was he? Had he got back from Gerag's territory? Had he taken a wrong turn? He did not recognize the tunnel and could see no markings on the wall. Metal scraped on rock nearby, and he twisted his head around, eyes reaching for the sound.
Mal. Alanor Mal. I must...
Gunfire pulled him from the dream of pain into the reality. Ekadon was half-lifting, half-dragging him across the deck, firing his pistol as he moved. Banners hung in the dark above him. Tatters of past wars hung in shadow. A blaze of bolter fire reached for them from the darkness. He could see warriors in black armor, and beyond them, set against the fire-laced sheet of night, a throne. The throne. And a figure on the throne, head bowed, wrapped in shadow.
Mal.
Light strobed beyond the viewport, blinking back the brilliance of the war in the void beyond. Ekadon dropped and dragged Malakhurst behind a pillar. He ejected and replaced the clip of his bolt pistol. How had he got here? The question drifted across the rolling sea of Malakhurst's mind, but then sank out of sight. It did not matter. There was always a way.
Mal.
There was no need for blood this time, he realized. There was blood enough on the deck already. Blood. There was blood on the throne. Blood pouring from the side of the figure who sat on it. Malakhurst opened his mouth. Iron breath hissed over his tongue.
Sire,
he gasped. The rotor blink of gunfire and a cry rising through the throne room and red on the steps before the shadowed throne, and... His hand was red as he raised it. His topknot hung lank against his neck, clotted with gore. He blinked away the dream of fire and iron and the blood-marked throne. A dream, yes. A death dream. He felt laughter come to his lips, and the movement sent a fresh wash of blood down his side from the wound beneath his ribs.
Death wound, he whispered,
and tilted his head back to rest against the wall behind him. It would end here, down this tunnel that he didn't even recognize. He thought of all the scheming, all the throats he had opened to try to make himself something greater, and in the end, it had been a blow from a sacred whelp he had not even seen until it was too late. That was a fitting punishment, he supposed. He had tried to create something greater than himself, not just rule over this tunnel or that, not just gather the oaths of war bands and gangs. Those were the small things, the petty things that had been attempted before. They passed. They were no greater than the vanity and the desperation of cruel men. No, his dream was of something greater still, a kingdom. A kingdom that would stretch from the deepest tunnel to the furthest minehead. A place that could pull itself up from the filth and blood. Now it would remain a dream.
You can have it, said a voice.
He looked up. A figure towered above him, the burning Prometheum that lit the tunnel staining its pale armor red.
You can be part of something greater than this life and suffering.
He blinked, feeling his vision swim as it tried to touch the face looking down at him.
No,
he said.
It did not happen like that. Horus was not there. No, he wasn't, said the figure. It was Cruz who found you in the tunnels, wasn't it? He found you and thought that the youth who dreamed of being a king would make a space marine.
Amarok stepped closer, and the impression of Horus drained back from Iacton Cruz's features. He was armored now, face lined and weathered by years.
You wanted to be a king, but always stayed a step behind your masters. So much power. But here you are.
The demon dipped a finger in the blood pooling beside Malachurst.
Dying of a new wound while dreaming of an old one, to try to save a creature that is not and never was human.
Malachurst grinned with the memory of bloody teeth.
You would not understand, he said.
The demon showed its teeth.
Horus, said Malachurst. Take me to Horus.
Which one? He is scattered and dying.
His essence pulled across existence. I can show you a part. But your war master is Alanor, said Malachurst,
knowing the answer even as it came to his lips.
Take me to Alanor.
Amarok seemed to let out a long breath and then nodded. It turned and began to walk. The tunnel pulled apart around it, motes of colour caught in a tumble of wind. Malachurst found himself standing, no longer the young Chthonian warlord he had been, but clad in armour, his frame just as twisted as it now was. He limped after the demon as the world blew past him. The dust swirled before his eyes, the image of Yakton Cruz the only thing he could see.
Why do you serve him? Asked the demon. You could have taken this opportunity for yourself. You could have left him to die, and his war to fail, and made yourself a greater warlord than any could dream.
Malachurst opened his mouth to spit a reply, but found a cold burst of laughter on his tongue.
Because he is my lord. Because if we are not striving for something greater than us, then what are we striving for at all? Because he is my friend.
Amarok did not reply, but walked on in silence for several steps.
Stay close, it said. We are almost there.
The swirl of dust began to change colour. Red streaked the grey. Malachurst felt the sting of sun on his skin. The smell of thruster fuel and burnt rock filled his nose. And then the sand and dust were gone, and he was walking beneath the dome of night, across a plateau of beaten earth and stone. Campfires glimmered in the dark, throwing flame light across the flanks of landing craft and war machines. Starships crossed the sky, brighter than the stars. Snatches of conversation and laughter came to him on the wind, but distant. The great highway that stretched before him waited in silence, and rising at its vanishing point was the imperial dais, carved from the bones of the mountain that it had replaced. Amarok faced him, waiting.
He is here?
Asked Malachurst.
Truly?
This is Alanor, said the demon.
This is where he always is, in his heart.
It turned and nodded towards the distant dais.
You have to walk the rest alone. I cannot go with you.
Malachurst took a step, then looked at the demon. It looked less like Yakton now, its face sharper, the hollows of shadow deeper. The wind gusted past him. The outline of Amarok was blurring, the edges dissolving into billowing dust.
Goodbye,
it said. The wind rose again, and on it Malachurst thought he heard voices that he knew. Loken, Torgadon, Sejanus. Then the air was still, and the dark was empty where the demon had been. Malachurst began to walk along the highway. He knew it. He remembered it. Alanor on the eve of the triumph. On the eve of everything that would come after. Now he was here. He did not need to seek Horus. He knew where his lord would be. He walked, limping, the taste of fire and dust in his mouth. Time passed in slow seconds, and with every step the feeling that this was no warp dream, but reality made again, grew stronger. The dais rose above him in increments, until it was a mountain of statues, steps, and pale stone made grey by night. He reached the base, found the flight of stairs beneath an arch, and began to climb. He passed a custodian walking one of the landings. The gold-plated giant looked at him and moved on without a word. He kept climbing until the stairs ended. A balcony spread from the door at its top. Its white marble seemed like carved snow. He stepped to the balustrade and looked down. The parade highway and the lights of the camps lay beneath him, a black sea still at the base of this island.
"Sire,"
he said softly without looking around.
"Mal?"
"Yes, sire,"
he said. He was still looking out at the black distance.
"I knew you would come."
"Did you, sire?"
The wind filled the pause.
"No."
"You need to come back,"
said Malachurst. Silence answered him.
"The war, the Legion, everything you have set into motion, it is coming apart. The dream is dying."
"I know."
"And yet you do nothing,"
said Malachurst. He felt the tiredness in the words. By all the oaths he had ever made, he was tired.
"You do nothing."
"I am fighting, Mal. I must win."
"Fighting."
He shook his head, eyes closing. For a second, the gunfire-streaked gloom of the throne room on the vengeful spirit filled the blackness behind his eyelids. The main doors had been opened. Black figures were advancing. The flares of bolt rounds were bars of fire stretching between guns and targets. The Lupakai were running into the fire, their images blurred silhouettes. Malachurst opened his eyes. The Knight of Ullinor was there again, calm and still.
"You are not fighting,"
he said, and turned. Horus stood next to him. His armor was white and bore none of the marks or the heraldry that it had taken in the 13 years that separated that night with the present.
"You are losing, sire."
Lyak. The final syllable rang across the space like the note of a struck bell, rising in pitch and volume. Lyak's throat burned and cracked. Wounds opened on his skin inside his armor. Time and substance slowed and expanded, and on the sound went. The mutants and human slave throng fell to the ground, bowels and stomachs voided. Some were dead before the breath of their last cry left their lungs. Others lay bleeding and weeping as the blood and excrement soaked into the tatters of silk and velvet. Stillness flowed out through the palace city. Wounds opened in the sky above. Blood fell. Fulgrim hung in the air, pinned in place like a moth in a display case. His body had shrunk to that of a fine-limbed youth, his white hair spilling around his head as he gasped for air. Burning marks covered his skin, weeping black pus as they tried to close. Lyak could not look at them, even though they were the echo of the word he had just spoken. The air had gone still. The only sounds were the hum of the remaining word-bearer's armor and the hiss of blood cooking on Kulnar and Hebek's blades. Lorgar turned his face to the bleeding heavens and closed his eyes. Lyak knelt behind him, flanked by his blade slaves. The red rain sizzled as it struck the pair's armor. Lyak forced himself to begin to stand. He could feel Fulgrim's mind and will battering against his own, but it was as though they were separated by a wall, and the cries and blows were weak and distant. He felt hollow, as though he were a shell skin around a void. Hollow man. The phrase sounded in his memory, and he looked to where Actea stood, shivering, bloody tears marking her face. She seemed to sense his gaze, and turned her face towards him, then turned away. The demon Inkari had halted in its charge, a pace from Lorgar. It stood quivering, red steam venting from its nostrils, its whole body flexing as though straining against a chain that held it in place.
"Be calm, O wrathful angel," Lorgar Aurelian said.
Inkari hissed, teeth wide, six-pronged tongue snapping in the air.
"You will suffer for this, priest!
I am the keeper of your soul's secrets, of your unborn dreams. I will tear them from...
No, said Lorgar, you will not. I serve the gods. If the Dark Prince wished this otherwise, then it would not have happened so. Ankari's muscles bloated, its head elongating into something that looked like a bull with a wolf's smile. It laughed then, the sound hooting and rumbling as the thick rain fell into the quiet. Lorgar turned his back on the demon and looked at Fulgrim. You are a beautiful thing, brother, said Lorgar. He raised his hand and brushed the back of a bloody gauntlet down Fulgrim's cheek. So blessed. So radiant. Fulgrim's eyes were burning with loathing. Lorgar gazed back at him, his face emotionless. But to be even the most favored instrument of a god is to do its will and to aid its purposes. You are beautiful and terrible. But you are an instrument now, brother. Nothing more. Lorgar looked at Lyak. Let him speak, he said. Fulgrim snarled as soon as Lyak willed him speech.
I will treat your soul and...
Your consort has already issued the necessary threats. I do not expect you to like this, brother. You were always too bound up in the ideal of yourself to see that you have to submit to greater powers and greater goals. You will hate me for this. You will loathe me with all the spite of your immortalized being. Fulgrim's eyes flashed. Lorgar held his gaze, face as calm as still water. You will hate me, but you will obey. And that is enough. Lorgar turned away and knelt, putting his fingers to the bloody ground and then touching them to his eyelids and forehead, chin, cheeks, and temples. We shall leave this place. You shall gather your legion and bring it to Ullinor, where Horus calls his muster. We shall go to him and strike him down. Fulgrim began to shake his head. Lorgar's hand snapped out and closed shut on Fulgrim's jaw. The white flesh burned under the grip. That is what will happen, because you are now a slave, Fulgrim, and the gods have put your chain in my hand. The fingers bit deeper, muscles formed and bunched beneath the skin on Fulgrim's spread arms. I take no pleasure in this power, brother. You are a sacred thing now, and I regret that this is necessary, but do not think that I will abstain from any means to see this crusade end. He looked into Fulgrim's eyes for a long moment, and then slowly, tenderly, planted a kiss on the demon's forehead. Then he turned and moved to where Lyak stood. Thank you, my son, he said. There was never another as devoted as you. Lyak bowed his head, but in his mind he thought he heard laughter at the back of his thoughts. Son, son, devoted, devoted. He had the sudden feeling that the mask was grinning at him from its inside surface, grinning where no one could see it. Give him the power to act, but not the power to disobey, said Lorgar. Lyak raised his head, his mind forming the web of will and command that spoke across the bonds linking him to Fulgrim. The demon Primarch arched and roared, fists and muscles bawling. He shook himself, wings now 6 pinions of perfect white feathers, pearlescent armor sheathed him. Ankari walked to Fulgrim's side, its bull-headed form shrinking and thinning until it was a slender figure wrapped in red silk, its skin the color of a shark's belly, its eyes black orbs. A delicate crest of bone and skin ran down the center of its scalp.
Where the prince of the princes goes, so go I, it said,
its voice a melody that promised bliss and suffering.
I am bound to this and to him. As you command him, so shall I follow your will. I shall raise no hand against you, nor shall I seek to break the bonds you have placed.
The demon's throat bulged, Hebeck stepped forwards, the hungering blade fused to him, twitching. Inkari did not move, though, but coughed, seeming to choke for a second before vomiting something onto the ground. It was wrapped in thick, black fluid, but rang hard as it hit the stones. Lorgar picked it up, smearing the black scum from its surface. It was a tooth, long and needle-tipped, its substance black and glassy. Light winked from its surface, each flash a different colour. Lyak found that his first instinct was to look away, and then that he did not want to look away. He knew what it was, had even possessed some, though never one from such an exalted creature as Inkari. It was a token, a bargain, given physical form. For some creatures, such a token might be a rusted shard of a sword, a splinter of bone, a perfect pearl. Whomsoever possessed the black tooth could summon Inkari to their side, command it, and would not be directly harmed by the creature. Not the total control of a binding, but a bond given physical form. A debt marker from the Sea of Souls. Lorgar nodded and handed the black tooth to Lyak. "So be it," he said, and looked to Fulgrim. "Your legion must be gathered." Fulgrim stared at him, contempt burning in the gaze. Then he shook his hair out and tilted his head back. His throat rippled, wet red gills opened, pouches of skin inflated. Fulgrim called into the abyss. It had no true sound, but reality blurred and vibrated as its silent note rose. Actea flinched, head twitching as blood ran from her ears. The blade slaves growled, the teeth of their swords grinding. Lyak heard it in his mind, echoing across his link with the demon. It was a command, a call to gather, like the cry of a wolf to its pack. Sensations and images came with it, fragments of nightmares and joy, the taste of a fruit picked just as it ripened, the gasp of someone dying in strangled terror, the warmth of flesh against the razor's edge. Out the call went, piercing time and space. It vibrated through the gene-laced blood of Fulgrim's bastard sons. On his throne, Eidolon heard it, and blood flooded the whites of his eyes. In the sound-drowned ruins of Nus, Glorocletion, apex of the Crescendio, heard the cry over the sounds of shattering stone and the screams of the dying. On Nettis's black sands, Lucius looked up from the scattered limbs on the ground beneath his sword. The faces on his armour swirled and echoed the call. In a thousand places of suffering, the children of the Emperor heard and raised themselves from the pleasure of their slaughter. They rose with bitterness in their hearts, with joy, with apathy, but rise they did. Ships broke from the orbits of mutilated worlds. Scattered fleets came about as they rode the frayed remnants of the ruined storm. From across the burning Imperium, the Emperor's children heeded the demand and the promise of their Primarch.
"You will have such pleasures. I will give you such things."
Fulgrim lowered his head and looked from Lyak to Lorgar.
"Done," he said with an acid smile. "So, shall we go?"
Inside his head, Lyak felt a laugh echo in the abyss of his soul. Argonis. Angron struck the summit of the hill as the iron warriors scattered. Steam poured into the air as the mud flashed to dust and then to glass. The demon Primarch rose, his movement a blur, the roar from his mouth shuddering through Argonis's flesh. He had asked Perturabo about this moment, about how he would deal with the creature that his brother had become. "As all conquest begins." "With his weakness," Perturabo had replied, and had given no further answer. On the summit of the hill, with the firewind of Angron's presence beating against his body and mind, Argonis could see no weakness in what the Primarch had become. Perturabo stood inside the ring of his iron circle, The hammer Forgebreaker hung in his left hand, its head alight with cold lightning. The automata had turned so that their shields faced in, forming a circle around the two Primarchs. Beyond them, down the flanks of the hill, the walls of the Iron Warriors' formation had driven through the World Eaters. Volleys of bolt rounds had ripped holes in the tide of howling legionaries. Tanks had ploughed through them, crushing bodies. Shield-bearers had followed in their wake, forming new lines of blood-streaked plasteel. It was no longer a defence. It was a strangling. Channeled, even as they killed, the World Eaters were now cut into pockets, contained. It would not hold, though.
"This is madness!" shouted Argonis. "It was always madness, Voice of Horus," said Forex.
The words edged with a cold chuckle.
"Now, it's just visible madness."
On the hilltop, Angron reared to charge at Perturabo.
"Fire," said Perturabo.
The Iron Circle obeyed. Fist-sized rounds tore into the demon Primarch. Explosions shattered against brass armor. Chunks of flesh and blood tore free, foaming into black ectoplasm as they fell. More units began to fire. Angron roared, his wings snapping wide as missiles and lasblasts tore them to tatters. The volume of fire was blinding, a lattice of angry light against the storm clouds. Angron came forwards, muscles pushing his form against the fire. Ikor drooled from gaping wounds, smoke and ashes shook from him. His flesh was remaking itself even as it was torn from him, swelling him so that he loomed above the crest of the hill, shivering with rage, radiating pain. For an instant, Argonis thought that the creature would fall. Then he seemed to shrink. Wounds closed. Armor glowed white and flowed into bullet holes. A high ringing noise filled Argonis's head, blotting out the sound of gunfire and the roll of thunder. He could feel nothing else, just the pain boring into the meat of his soul and burning down his nerves. And he knew that it would go on forever unless he stood, unless he poured it into the world as rage and let it coat his hands red. The deluge of fire intensified. But Angron had taken a step forwards, and the blasts and shots were vanishing into the shadow of his shape. The demon that had been a Primarch charged. Space folded as he moved. Features dissolved in a blur. His wings were slices of fast-moving shadow, his strides a flicker. The storm dragged after him. Lightning arced down, spearing through warriors and war machines. A tank exploded, its ammunition and fuel cooking off and punching its turret up into the air. A cluster of World Eaters became ash as power arced through them. Blood cooked and rose in charring globules. Argonis watched, unable to move, unable to turn his mind to action. This was not simply a creature of destruction. It was a force of annihilation that was not meant to share the same realm as mortals. He saw an axe form in Angron's hand. Its edge was a slit of sharpened light. Reality tore as it cut. Smoke bled from the wound left behind its edge. Perturabo was a statue of metal standing in the shadow of death. The axe cut. Perturabo moved aside. Even layered in armor and pistons, he was still faster than Argonis could dream, fast enough to almost avoid the blow. But nothing that was even half-mortal could have avoided that cut. The axe struck his shoulder. White light blazed. For a second he could only see white, and then the neon scar burned onto the back of his eyes. He heard more blows fall, each one screaming louder than gunfire. In the pit of his soul, he thought of all the duties he had done Horus in the hope of clawing back the feeling of brotherhood that had been everything but was now just a memory. This would not just be failure. This would be death. He would end here, another heap of butchered meat on a world that was a graveyard of bones in a galaxy they had set ablaze. It all ended here. Redemption, brotherhood, and the lie of a higher purpose. His sight cleared. Perturabo still stood. Impossibly, the Lord of Iron stood. Glowing scars marked the plates of his armor. Blood hissed as it ran over orange iron. But he stood. and Forgebreaker was rising in his grasp, its head a comet as it swung. Angron did not move to avoid the blow. He was swinging again, roaring, blood-slicked cables lashing around his head. Like all the other blows he had struck in the last second, it was faster than the eye that saw it. But Perturabo had timed his blow and slid it into the split-second gap as Angron swung back to strike again. The hammer struck. Forged by Fulgrim for the brother he had murdered, then given by Horus to Perturabo, it was a weapon that transcended even the craft put into its making. The hammerhead hit Angron's chest. Brass armor shattered. The shockwave ripped outwards. Argonis felt it pass through him. Angron staggered. Perturabo stepped forwards, the hammer swinging back in a blurred sheet of lightning. Angron rammed forwards before Perturabo could strike, and now it was Perturabo going back, armor blackening as furnace flame breathed from Angron's teeth. The axe struck again, and again, blows that could end titans falling. Fresh wounds opened in Perturabo's armor, but still he stood.
"You think I am weak?"
Perturabo's voice boomed from the grill of his helm. Angron struck him twice again. Splinters of metal fell from the Lord of Iron as he staggered once more.
"But you have grown weaker, Angron."
The demon Primarch lashed a kick into Perturabo and struck once, twice, three times as the Lord of Iron stumbled back and crashed to his knees.
"I have learnt. I have remade my strength, while you have sold yours out of despair."
Argonis heard the words, heard the spite in them, the cold bitterness. There was something else there, too. Something that made Argonis think of the knife jewels in the dark warrens of Chthonia. Cuts meant to goad, not kill. Angron roared, and in the fraction of time that gave, Perturabo was on his feet, Forgebreaker moving faster than before. The air shook as its head struck and struck again, and there was blood on the baked mud of the ground beneath the two. Angron was scattering burning blood and broken armor. He lashed a fist at Perturabo. Claws tore the front from the Lord of Iron's helm. Perturabo's skin was pale grey, streaked with blood beneath.
"You are weak," snarled Perturabo. "You are a slave. You were born a slave, and a slave you remain."
Angron cut Perturabo. Argonis did not see it done, just the Lord of Iron suddenly still, a crimson trail running down his chest and glowing gashes smiling across his torso. Angron was striking again, but somehow he seemed to be shrinking, the edges of his shadow and flame bulk retreating like a wave from the shore. Perturabo struck back, and hammer and axe met.
"Your strength flees," roared Perturabo. "It does not belong to you. It is your master's, and the chain that keeps you throttles you. The threads of blood are thinning. The meal of slaughter will only keep you here long enough to see your bastard sons die."
Beside Argonis, Forex heard the words and keyed a control on his vox. Rounds began to hammer into the divided world-eaters. It had only been seconds since the Iron Warrior's formation had entered its last configuration, and now Argonis saw that its weakness to further attack up the hill was a simple trade-off. Vulnerability sold to allow for slaughter. In a few more minutes, the world-eaters would have broken out of their corral, Argonis had no doubt, but they would not have that chance. Mortars thumped explosives into the kettled 12th Legion. Cannons roared in overlapping sweeps. World-eaters fell, torn apart, their fury no more than bloody mist coughed from shredding lungs. Angron turned towards the circle of automata surrounding them. His axe lashed out, burning gouges across the front of the circle of shields, again and again, scoring deep.
"Their skin is my skin," called Perturabo. "A gift of suffering at the hands of our brother."
He was walking towards Angron, limping but hammer in hand.
"You think that I would let your kind wield your weapons against me? I have taken their measure."
Angron whirled, wings extending to carry him back to his brother. Perturabo raised his hands, weapon pods unfolding from his armored shell. Angron's tattered shadow wings beat. Perturabo fired. Streams of energy and exotic rounds blazed across the space between the two. Fire and explosions wreathed Angron. Ectoplasmic smoke billowed off him. His wings were broken frames of bone draped with scraps of skin. Perturabo came forwards as he kept up the fusillade, each step a slow thud of braced pistons.
They will die here on this hill. They will die without striking a blow. All your best mongrel sons of slaughter, they will die, and your battered soul will watch as it sinks back into the dark.
Angron was an outline now, a thing of threads remaking itself even as it was unraveled into smoke. Argonis heard a sudden fizz of signal distortion in his ear. Forex stiffened beside him.
What's happening?
Forex did not answer, but turned to a bulbous helm signals officer at his side. Argonis was about to demand an answer when a movement pulled his sight back to the hilltop. Volk stepped from between the iron circle. His body was skinned in gunmetal. He was taller again, bulked to the size of a dreadnought by recoil pistons and tangled ammo feeds. Muzzles and focusing arrays pushed from his arms and shoulders. Cables sprouted from his skin and then plunged back into his body. His skull face had sunk into the mass of his shoulders, mirror eyes fixed on Angron. The demon Primarch twitched, as though sensing the presence of a threat or rival. Volk fired. Pistons and sinew snapped as they swallowed the recoil. Beams of energy and blizzards of rounds tore into Angron. The noise was overwhelming. The roar of every battlefield in history blended together into a symphony. Argonis knew the sound, though he had never heard it like this. It had surrounded him all his life in fragments. The buzz of cooking air, the thump of cannons and the chatter of pistols. It was the sound of the tools of war, but undivided, concentrated, whole. Angron was pushed backwards. Holes were punched and burned through him. He was alight, illuminated by a river of gunfire and explosions. Flakes of ash boiled from his torn flesh, and Volk kept firing. Shell casings littered the ground at his feet, each of them glittering for seconds before collapsing into ectoplasm. Perturabo gestured. The gunfire ceased across the hillside. Volk stopped an instant later. The guns projecting from his flesh sunk and regrew in different places. Argonis remembered his old friend's words on the slope of the mountain fortress.
The end was only a dream.
And what do dreams matter?
Angron turned back to Perturabo.
His rage roiling off his remaining presence, he took a step forwards. But he was becoming slower and weaker, his wings dragging on the ground, his skin splitting as his muscles bunched in his shoulders.
You are a betrayer,
said Angron, his voice the hiss of quenched flame. And then Perturabo stepped forwards and swung his hammer once. Angron fell. The baked ground split beneath his fall. Argonis saw him writhe, his shape and substance a flicker blur of features. A noble-faced warrior, a muscled monster with the head of a hound and a collar of brass, a towering shadow of red flame and corpse smoke. There was no complete image to grasp, just the echo of pain and rage filling Argonis's head as the broken creature clawed towards the Lord of Iron. Perturabo stood still. Blood and oil ran from his armor. A network of gouges and splits ran across it. Gears and servos shrieked as he shifted weight. His hammer was loose in his hand. He was a ruin, but he still stood, looking down at his once brother.
Coward!
Argonis thought he saw Perturabo open his mouth to reply, but nothing came from the bloody lips. Volk moved towards them, pistons bracing, releasing and reforming with each step. He stopped, and the weapons grown from his limbs reconfigured again. Heat was bleeding off him, shimmering in the air around his form. A white-orange glow seeped from the joins in his armor, as though a furnace were building heat within him. Fire began to gather in the mouths of the guns.
"Do you wish this to end?"
said a voice that came from Volk, but was the voice of the demon in the pit of Sarum. Perturabo looked at Volk, and then back to the withering shape of Angron.
It can end, said the voice.
And Argonis could not tell whether it was talking to Perturabo or Angron, or whether it was a question or a promise. A quiet had fallen over the hill. The storm clouds had flattened to a sullen silence. Even the fury of the world-eaters as they beat against the Iron Warrior's lines abated, as though the sea of their rage drew down the shore.
We can end, said Volk again. Not in dissolution. Not in a return to the realm of pain, but in obliteration.
Volk looked at Perturabo.
The sword lies in your hand, Lord of Iron.
Argonis kept his eyes on the thing on the ground. Angron was a withered creature under the gaze of the guns, a fire-blackened gargoyle. Black slime was dripping from him. His mane of cables hung lank over his shoulders. Dissolving flesh hung from the spurs of his wings.
Cowards!
Angron's head turned. A blood-blister eye fastened on Volk from beneath a lid of charred skin. Argonis's gaze was locked. He did not know what he was seeing. A god of war made small. Pain in eyes of hate. He did not know how he wanted the next moments to unfold.
We have to move, said Forex.
Argonis blinked.
We have to move now.
The first captain was shoving through the ranks of warriors towards the Iron Circle and Perturabo.
Lord!
He called. But Perturabo did not move or look away from Angron and Volk. Forex reached his side. Argonis shook himself and suddenly heard the signals flashing across the vox.
What is the will of Iron?
Said Volk, in the dry flame voice of the demon.
Does he end or endure?
Perturabo still did not answer.
Lord,
said Forex, daring to step between Perturabo and the withered Angron. Perturabo's gaze moved from Angron to his first captain.
A hostile fleet is approaching, said Forex. Crusade displacement at the least. Full battle array.
Gilliman, said Perturabo.
Forex nodded. A low growling sound creaked through the air. At first, Argonis did not know what it was. Then he saw that what remained of Angron's mouth had cracked into something that might have been a smile, if a cooked dog could smile.
You have danced too long on the shoreline, said Angron.
His voice held no anger, no rage. It was empty, the voice of windborne dust burying a battlefield so that no one would remember it had existed. Perturabo stepped forwards, but the last of Angron's substance was fading, its edges losing substance, the ache of his presence in the world fading.
All is sand. Red sand under our feet. Now the tide comes in.
From across and beyond the hillside, the howl of the world-eater's chain axes rose, spluttering and revving as they struck sparks from the Iron Warrior's walls. Argonis felt himself remembering the sound of dust jackals calling across the plateaus of terror. It was not the sound of a challenge or the promise of death. It was laughter. Perturabo was looking up. Above them the storm clouds were clearing from a night sky blinking with the false stars of warships.
We can clear the system before the Ultramarines reach the planet if we pull back into orbit now, said Forex. What is your will, Lord?